Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, and how the best writers risk being strange. So I'm talking with Aaron Giovannone, and this book specifically that I want to talk about, Aaron, is, of course, The Nonnets, you know, your second book. Because I'm teaching it in a class here at the University of Winnipeg, and there's a couple of specific reasons, you know, I kind of want to get into about, like, you know, why I like this book and why I like to teach it. But I wouldn't mind just kind of starting a little earlier with sort of your first book a little bit and some of the things you were doing in that book, just that kind of like, and how that book may pave the way for The Nonnets for you a little bit. In some ways, because I first came to your work through that first book, I had just been sent it basically by your publisher. So I was doing a lot of book reviews at the time. And I remember distinctly reading that book in the basement, you know, just kind of laying on the couch late at night reading the book. And one of the poems you indicate, you say, you know, here's my phone number. Text me. That's my real number. And I texted it to see if it was your real number. And, you know, sure enough, it was. You replied to the text. And So I thought it was a very interesting kind of exchange there, in the sense that I think, if I remember right, you noted that nobody had ever texted you before on it.
I think you were the first. A few people did, though, and that was. I mean, that's a book from about 10 years ago now. So that's an era when social media has pretty thoroughly penetrated our social discourse and our way of communicating, but certainly not to the extent that it is now, which is feels like a whole nother thing. So I think with that poem, I was experimenting with modes of direct address. Like, imagine if I were actually talking to somebody through this poem. Imagine the person sitting there reading it. How would I actually be able to communicate with them in a way that's not fully constrained by the words on the page? And so, I mean, that at the time, like, the obvious thing was to, okay, well, let's just go for let's see if people will actually text me. And it was kind of a joke, but it kind of wasn't. I was quite happy to get texts when I did, and I think probably overall I got probably 15 or 20 different readers who texted me. And I think it was a year or two later, there was a review of the book, The Loneliness Machine, we're talking about. There was a review of it in, maybe it was in Canadian Literature. They take a while. I mean, I remember, Jonathan, your book reviews were always quick. They were always coming out in a timely fashion. And, it was so nice for you to, like, you know, to read that book and review it the way you did. This review came out 2 years later, and the reviewer was disappointed that when he texted me, I didn't respond. And it wasn't that I didn't respond on purpose, but it was actually that I had changed my phone number. I had moved and I had to change my phone number. So there may be, I don't know how many other people out there over the years have tried to text me and gotten no reply, or somebody who has my old phone number now. They're like, every now and then, they're like, this is the weirdest, the weirdest text I get. Like, you know, once every 6 months, somebody texts me.
I never thought about that. Someone else has that number now. Yeah.
And I feel like, in a way, for a while, I regretted that I had to change my phone number. And in a way, maybe it's almost more, there's a kind of beauty to that fact now that those messages are going to a stranger, maybe.
Or to the abyss. One of the things I liked about that book a lot, and which I think the reason I bring it up is because I think some of these themes are still being extended in The Nonnets in different ways. But one of the things I liked about The Loneliness Machine is, one, I liked how the title became a metaphor for the book, you know, the book as a loneliness machine, poetry as a loneliness machine, one that's kind of, in a sense, commodifying your loneliness and making it into a product. But also, you know, a thing that is at the same time, authentically capturing, you know, how a person might feel and, you know, expressing and communicating. Like, there was the first time I really felt that I'd seen a book that extensively and in a fun but also serious way, dealt with the idea of the poem as an interface, and even like a cell phone, having it being the poem being this kind of medium of communication, which you'd there's a history of poets doing that, but they're very optimistic. They're very optimistic about the ability of poetry to transmit one's ideas across time, or to speak to people thousands of years from now. Interestingly, they have less of an interest historically in just communicating to the person right across from you right now. And I thought, what was interesting about The Lonely Machine, it was sort of like you had this interesting metaphor of like the poem as the way you were going to kind of interact and communicate, the poem as the interface that would help you reach another like mind, but also the actual activity of writing the poem was literally separating yourself from that situation, in order to produce the poem, to communicate with somebody and interface with them in this kind of more authentic way than just texting them off the phone, you had to sequester yourself away from everyone and write the poems, and really work on the craft. So I thought that it really cleanly and simply, and in a way that was both serious but also kind of fun, dealt with a lot of the that really complicated relationship that literature and art has for as a sort of interface between individuals, or even between cultures or time periods in an interesting way. So I felt like I'm really interested kind of to know just sort of to what degree you think that's an accurate way of looking at what you were doing with that book. In what ways were you kind of thinking about that approach or that those sorts of themes when you were putting together the nonnets?
Yeah, I was thinking about all of those things. I wasn't necessarily explaining it to myself in such an articulate way, but I was definitely writing from a place of being alone. I mean, lots of writers have different kinds of lives. They have, they have spouses, they have kids, they have roommates, they have many pressures on their time and many, sounds and voices interfering with their work. And that when I was writing The Loneliness Machine, I was living by myself in Calgary. I was a grad student. I'm talking to you from Calgary right now. I've lived in Calgary for like on and off for 20 years at this point, but with extended periods living elsewhere, working elsewhere, and just my life and my work has brought me back here. I'm happily quite happy here. But so in 2012, I'm working on my PhD. The more social period of a doctorate is the early years when you have some coursework and you're just getting to meet some of your cohorts, your fellow students, and so you're getting that's a bit more of a social time. And by the time you enter the last couple of years of a PhD, you're working on a thesis. And so, the ideal situation really is to have time alone, quiet time to do that. And so I was very lucky in having that time to myself. And so I was kind of writing The Loneliness Machine off the side of my desk as I was also working on a PhD thesis and finding a way to express some of those feelings of isolation, but a desire to communicate. I was expressing those feelings through the Loneliness Machine. So yeah, I mean, that's a great contradiction that you never really get over when it comes to writing for publication, because you have to spend a lot of time alone to do it. You just need to. And I honestly, I quite crave alone time. Quite often I want that. But often you get too much of it and you don't even realize that, oh, you know what? I haven't talked to anybody in like 2 days. This was a lot easier to do back then as well.
That's a really interesting point, actually, in and of itself, that sometimes people who aren't writers or who aren't involved in a PhD might not realize. Like I must have just missed you, because I graduated from the University of Calgary with a PhD in 2009.
Yeah.
So that was sort of when I came out and left.
Yeah, I was. I arrived a year later. I arrived a year later. Yeah.
Sure.
So I'd heard. Yeah, I knew of you. People had mentioned you and your work. And we never crossed paths, did we? Yeah.
No, but also I remember distinctly though, there was the one day where I was, you know, in deep in that, you know, thing of working on the project and so on and so forth. And I went out to the, you know, just, I was like, I'm done with, I got to go out, do something. So I went out to the bookstore to Pages on Kensington. And I remember distinctly, I went to open my mouth and like say something to the person. My voice is like croaking. I could barely speak. And I realized I hadn't spoken a word for days.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's not an uncommon experience for people. And, you know, I mean, you know, that's probably, that experience was magnified and extended for so many people during like pandemic lockdowns. So, I mean, loneliness is a mass epidemic in a lot of ways. And so in my own way, I was exploring that with the artistic tools that I had available. And, but I also, you know, as sad as that sounds, like, you know, the last thing, if you're trying to like make friends, if you're trying to have a conversation and have fun and want to build a relationship that another person will seek out again with you, you can't be sad like that, you know? So you have to try to be entertaining. You have to try to be happy and you have to try to make jokes. And that was always such a big part of writing that book. And especially the nonits was like, I just like, you know, this has to be funny. This just has to be entertaining. And for however dark or lonely the place that it's coming from, I really hope people are smiling and laughing when they're reading this.
I find the more comical aspects of the book make the less comical aspects underscored in a particular way. Like, so where this all kind of dovetails to me in the nonets is when you get a poem like, I guess that none of the titles, but you get a poem where on page 7, it begins like, I looked up what nonplussed means, dictionary.com pronounced it for me. No, I won't do a robot voice for you. By the end of that, you've got, you know, this great stanza. Then you talk about, you know, being, you know, fished for your visa number.
Yeah.
And then the speaker says, reader, speak to me. Are you there? Are you also nonplussed? A human's writing this, I swear. Like that line, a human's writing this, I swear, is really interesting in, you know, the modern age of, you know, AI anxiety. But also, like when the book came out, it was a moment that I kind of flagged in my own reading because I remembered The Loneliness Machine and some of the themes there. And again, that idea of the poem is kind of an interface. Like the reason you don't know whether that's a real person or a bot is because of the interface. And the poem is also sort of operating in a level like an interface. I mean, we do know that a human wrote that poem, but there's still that level of distrust that comes, like you get into these philosophical questions of, you know, how do you actually know? Like when I teach this book, I get into some of these ideas, like how do you know whether another I get into what the philosophical zombie is, you know, the P zombie, we talk about the Turing test, you know, and all these other things sort of become relevant in terms of like, how do you actually determine what another consciousness is or is doing or how it's approximating, what parts of it are important to approximate if you're trying to convince, you know, another person of your consciousness and of your intelligence, of your, you know, emotional capacity, which is of course exactly the things that you're doing when you're writing a poem and a lyrical poem and trying to convince the reader that you've got this connection with them, you know. You have a very subtle way of getting into very complicated things. And I'm curious to know how that style has sort of developed for you, because you have a style that looks very easy. But if, you know, a person has written for quite a while, like they can recognize the moves and how difficult that style really is. So I'm curious to know just how you kind of developed your style exactly. Like who are the sort of the influences on that? And where did you kind of, why did you kind of gravitate in that direction?
Great. Oh, those are great questions. Thanks. In terms of, I guess I'll start with the like other writerly influences. My PhD thesis was like a translation project of Italian poetry. into English. And so I was studying a lot of Italian modernists, and these are, you know, like mid-century Italian writers, Italian poets. And a couple that really that I ended up spending a lot of time with was one guy named Sandro Penna, and another fellow who was kind of sent a young older man who was also Penna's kind of his mentor. His name is Umberto Saba. And both of those men, in their different ways, have a way of making it look easy. So obviously they're writing in Italian, and so Italian has a lot of rhyming and sonic possibilities that English maybe doesn't always have. Now, I have to point out too, as someone who's worked a lot in Italian and translation and stuff, that is a bit of that idea that, oh yeah, like a Latin language, like Italian, is just so beautiful. It sounds so poetic already. The truth is, like, English sounds pretty good too. It has plenty of sonic possibilities, rhyming possibilities in it too. So I feel like it's a bit of a canard, that thought that it's easy to write in Italian. It's easy to write poetry in Italian. It's easy to rhyme in Italian. But I do want to say, these guys, Saba and Penna, they really had a way of saying something that seemed so clean and so easy and so direct in a kind of demotic, like a spoken Italian, the way that you would just, I mean, maybe more eloquently than normal, but you could imagine someone speaking aloud. And then you look at it on the page and you're realizing this thing is like a rhyming quatrain. This is like regular rhythm to this, and you read it aloud to yourself and you're realizing this text has so many really rigorous formal elements that contribute to making it sound smooth and easy. So those two guys, their writing really impressed me. And I was trying to write, like them in English. So, you know, a question of translation is always, of course, you know, well, what does this other text say? What is its content? What is its overt meaning? But when you're dealing with poetry, like, so much of the meaning is also coming from the formal qualities of the language, how it sounds. And because that influences, you know, how you are being emotionally impacted by the text. So I was trying to do what they did, you know, in English. And just, so my goal was always to make this sound natural, to make this sound normal, to make this sound spoken. And, but also, like, I wanted every chance I got, I wanted to get assonance in there. I wanted to get a rhyme in there. I mean, I remember people at the time saying, are you really going to rhyme in your poetry, Aaron? Like, that's so, I mean, this is a while ago now, but it was like out of fashion, especially in academic contexts, to rhyme. And I was like, hell yeah, I'm going to rhyme. It's like, what makes this interesting? It's the rhyme. So that's a couple of writerly influences from Italian, for the tone, for the easygoingness, for the sense of humor. I really took a lot from Frank O'Hara. He, again, was a mid-century American poet and not known for writing formally rigorous work, or at least not traditionally formalistic work. Like, he doesn't write in quatrains or couplets with end rhyme, but he had a way of writing very conversational lines. And it literally, at times, he was having a conversation with someone. It was an imagined conversation with a friend, and it was so easygoing, and it was so funny, and it was so charming. And this stuff, Frank O'Hara was quite popular, I would say, in your average graduate poetry seminar like 10 years ago. And I'm not sure if he's still de rigueur now, but his stuff was really, really fun. And I love that tone. So those are a few writerly influences. One more influence I would say was on the form that the nonets eventually took, is that I always did imagine reading them, performing them. I have to be honest, this isn't going against anybody who likes this kind of poetry, but I'm not really a fan of spoken word, at least what I've seen of it. But what has been happening in the last 10, 15, 20 years is that spoken word has been taking like a big part of at least what the public what a public thinks of poetry, and it's very popular, and lots of people do it, and that's great. So that kind of public performance aspect of poetry started to impinge more and more on how I was thinking about my own work. And so I always read these aloud to myself. I always imagined myself performing them. And I often thought of like the extra ironies that would come into play when I was actually there in person saying these aloud, when, you know, because so much of, you know, we're talking about the loneliness machine working on the absence of the reader, or the absence of the writer. You know, I guess it depends what perspective we're speaking from, but the absence of one or the other, and how that there's a kind of short circuit and a spark that can happen when you're actually in the same room again, and in doing that, and how much fun that could be, how much energy that could bring to the performance, just having those absence, those gaps filled all of a sudden. So live performance, reading aloud, also influenced how I was going to write the nonnets from the beginning.
Yeah, I never thought about that, but yeah, I'm just looking at the poem begins. When Greenpeace canvassers stop me, I say I'm late for a meeting. This is the meeting. Like, that would read so much differently if you were there performing it. Yeah, I never considered that, but you're right.
Yeah, this meeting with the text, you know, coming here to write this or to speak to you. Yeah, gotta go. Gotta go, guys. Sorry. You know?
Yeah.
Dodging or the fundraisers.
At the end of that poem, even you've got that, you know, a silver maple with twinkling leaves. Just kidding, there's no tree, you know. So again, like that idea would be sort of the same idea in performance, but it would have been set up in a very different manner. And so the whole thing would twist in a kind of different direction potentially.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that the poems worked both ways, but I did often think about performing them and how much fun that would be. Maybe coming out of the more cloistered time of my life when I was writing The Loneliness Machine, partway through the nonets, I met my now wife, and so we started to live together and stuff. So I think maybe some of the lonely energy maybe dissipated a little bit, and I started to, I don't know, I'm not sure if that was part of a slightly different approach to the nonets, where I imagined the reader there with me, and maybe it actually happens sometimes, you know. But yeah, I'm not sure what else I could say about the maybe this is probably a question like why nonets, like why
well that
not?
Was my next question, you know. Where'd you hit on the idea of this form, and how did you see it relating to the sonnets form that gives it its name?
Yeah, it was the name nonnet is kind of, it's not even really it's not really an official poetic term for a 9-line poem. I mean, you can find it somewhere, but like an actual nonnet is a bit of a recent invention, and it actually is a kind of a writing exercise where if you look up the definition of nonnet, it is 9 lines, but it's like every line has, I don't remember exactly, it's like every line has like the first line has one word, and then the next line has two words, and the next, so it's like not only are there 9 lines, but each line has a number of words relating to what sequence this line is. Anyway, it's complicated. And that was, it's kind of seemed kind of silly, like a little bit too much for me. So I just went with 9. Something about, you know, the sonnet, obviously like the big poetic form, the one with the most historical weight behind it. So I was sort of playing with, I liked the word nonnet for how it evoked the word sonnet, but then also has, you know, the letters like no, it says no. So it's kind of like not a sonnet if you smush them together. So I kind of like that. I mean, that's just kind of a game for myself a little bit, but it's as if it is a kind of form, but it's not too serious of a form. It's like pretty, in some ways it's kind of easy. So I feel like that was part of me choosing, going with the word nonnet. This is silly, but it's like, oh yeah, my name is like Jovanone. Jovanone. It has like a version of nonnet sort of in it. Like a lot, not exactly, but I was like, okay, it sounds a little bit like my name too. And thinking less serious, more playful moments. I was like, maybe I'll name these the Jovenonets. Something like really, really stupid. So I'm glad I didn't do that. But you get a sense of like the, yeah, like the comic energy that I was working with here. You know, the form is, it could have been anything. I mean, I guess it could have been, I could have had four stanzas instead of three. I mean, I guess there's something very clean and direct about the nine line form. You have three stanzas, just as each stanza has three lines. So there's this mirroring at the smaller level, the micro level, and at the macro level. That's just a very pleasing kind of symmetry to me. I love the way they look on the page.
You also often employ something like an argumentative structure and something like a volta turn. You know, you don't exactly do it all the time, but you're often in that realm of kind of setting up a tension immediately, and then kind of like in the first stanza, and then by the third stanza, turning it in a different direction. It's not a rule per se, but I feel like that has that sonnet like energy in that same way.
Yeah, that was something I came across just over the many, many drafts of these poems, is realizing that's what I was doing. The best poem that had the most kind of narrative thrust, conceptual surprise, was having a turn at some point. And yeah, often it comes in the end. I think that's probably the most satisfying. But there might be like a little bit more, there might be like quite a turn even from stanza to stanza. Those ones, it depends. Like that's sometimes hard to follow. And so, yeah, I do try to set a scene and then undermine it in some way. That wasn't obvious. It seems obvious to say something like that. It's a very like perceptive, but I didn't like think I was doing that for a while until I realized how these were coming together. What I liked about the form and just coming at this with the form, I figured out, okay, this is a form I like, I seem to work well in it, I'm just going to do this for the whole book. Once I understood I was doing that, I found it very, very generative, because in some ways the question you come to a poem with was always solved for me then. And now it was a question of like, well, how do I do that thing I know I need to do with the material, the content that I have? So a lot of, you know, the individual lines or stanzas, scenes, events, characters in these poems, they just come straight out of like a journal. Like I was journaling very, very attentively in those days. And I always had my phone with me, had a Google Doc open for the day. And I was writing down everything when I had a moment to do it. And people made fun of me. This was a period of a couple of years where it's like, oh, Aaron on his phone again or whatever. And this is before you could be addicted to TikTok or anything like that. So I was just like, I don't know if they knew what I was doing there. I was like, I would tell them that I was writing down what they said, and I'd read it to them. I'd laugh out loud. And actually sometimes their reaction would then go in my notes. And so I was really drawing from my journals every day and finding these little tidbits that would find a place somewhere in the nonet form. Yeah.
So then what did the process of editing and revising this book look like? Did you have, you know, way too much material, or were you kind of building up from a base of material? Like what did it actually look like to kind of get it in the form it ended up in?
Yeah, extremely, this is academic-y, extremely iterative, like extremely repetitive. I went over these probably hundreds of times. Not that, I mean, they're short, so I could do that. But I had, you know, if there are 63 poems, 6 + 3 = 9. There are 63 poems. That is how I chose the final number.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Yeah. There are 63 poems. I think in an earlier, the layout for the book used to have them numbered, but then I didn't really like how it looked on the page to have a numeral, like a Roman numeral at the top of every poem. And I just went with, I thought maybe it's kind of a little bit of an Easter egg for, or just at least it's something surprising that I could tell people. It's like, oh yeah, no, there are 63 of these. I had like 150 at least, probably at least that many in draft form. And then over the years, going through them, realizing, don't like the stanza, don't like that line. I think the only thing from this existing nonet is one line and I'm taking that, and finding, and then, you know, with that kind of distilled tidbit, remember this is coming from my journals anyway. So I have a ton of stuff in my journals. I'm distilling it down into, say, 150 nonets. And from there, I'm distilling the best bits into eventually 63 of them. So it was just the process of reading them over and over again, forgetting about them and coming back and just looking for that moment of surprise and delight and following that and taking that little bit and combining it with another moment of surprise and delight and seeing if that, if they had some sort of narrative tension, did it work? Did it work narratively? Like, are these evoking the same scenery? Like, are we in the same place? I often thought of a nonet, okay, we have to be somewhere. The thoughts, the ideas, the associations, the jokes, they can be pretty wild. And the audience can follow you if you evoke a time and a place, and if you can sort of physically, imaginatively place your reader with you somewhere. So that became a way I composed as well, thinking about, okay, where does this nonet take place? This one's in a cafe. Like, this one's out on the sidewalk. This one's on my bike. This one's like alone in my bedroom. Like, you know, things that I was also thinking sort of in terms of location as I was editing these down.
Can you talk a bit about, one of the other things that it strikes me about this book is I feel like it's one of a number of books in this sort of period in Canada that really, the other person I think a lot of is, he has a very sort of different style from you, but I think a lot of, in terms of some of the same ideas, is my friend Ryan Fitzpatrick. Okay. Who said, he texted me to say hi to you, by the way.
Oh, nice. Hi, Ryan.
But I don't know if you ever took a look at his book, Fake Math, the first book that he did. But it has a lot of, it's very different stylistically, but I think it has a similar, and a lot of Ryan's work has a similar, I think, I don't know if he would say this, but I would say about both him and you, and a number of other kind of people in the mix. I think of myself actually in a lot of ways, like my book, I don't know if you've seen my book, The National Gallery, but this book, your work was very influential on that particular book.
Oh,
and specifically this thematic idea that I think you're often getting at, which is sort of a desire to trust poetry and a distrust of poetry, if that makes sense, being kind of held in attention. And often I find like the poems are thematically delving into that tension.
The distrust of poetry, the, you know, the very form that I was working in. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Very, very skeptical of poetry. You know, I grew up, you know, very, not in a particularly literary household. It wasn't like there were, we didn't have huge library shelves. You know, we didn't have the kind of reading that was done in the house was, my mom liked, you know, mystery novels, and my dad wasn't, it wasn't really an influence in any way. And then there was one book on the shelf that was, the selected works of Robert Frost. There was one poetry book on the shelf. And I remember at a young age, just kind of plucking that out and reading it. And that was probably, like, honestly, the first poetry I read. And then when I got a little older, was a teenager, young teenager, and maybe around 16, 17, I was starting to write poems myself. I like really like Leonard Cohen. So, and, you know, and I actually probably did come to Leonard Cohen first through his poetry and then got more into his music. Of course, his music is why people really remember his poetry in any capacity today. But I think that gave me the sense that poetry had some kind of a public profile, at least the kind of poetry, this kind of poetry that I was interested in did have some sort of a public profile. There was some kind of readership out there. There was, you know, what I discovered a little bit later as I got into university, I went to university and I was studying literature and then eventually creative writing, is that, yeah, poetry, like, it doesn't have a huge audience. It's probably never really had a huge audience, but the place where poetry does have some readership and some cultural capital, some clout, was amongst the university educated, amongst the professional class, especially amongst professors and students in a literature department, but you could say more generally in humanities. And I think even a little bit more broadly, like, yeah, anybody who went to university and had to take or chose to take like a literature course or two, there used to be more of that required. I think like humanities had used to like humanities such as literature had a much bigger part in university education. Even when I'm talking about 20 years ago, right? And never mind 20 years before that. So I think that the sort of the trend has been for, I mean, a couple of things is I do think that the poetry that I loved as a kid and grew up to write and enjoyed writing, I think as I got a little bit older, I started to have some doubts that anybody was going to read it. Even that very restricted audience amongst the university educated that I've talked about, I wondered even if how many of those folk would read it or care about it or enjoy it. So there was some skepticism about my audience and who they were, really. That's part of that kind of that sometimes kind of groping desperation for who's there, reader, are you there, someone there? I mean, that's kind of part of what's happening, is wondering about the diminished audience for poetry. And but I mean, at the same time, you know, what I've seen in poetry is that, yeah, I've talked about spoken word, and that has in the last 20 years taken up has a bigger public profile, and there are more people doing that, and that's great. Much more populist form of poetry. You know, it's performative. It's in the moment. It's energetic. It can draw a crowd to an evening event or whatever. And there's national competitions, all that stuff. So there's more of an audience. There's a bit more of a populist version of poetry. And then, you know, when we're talking about social media, you know, you're thinking about, it's really platform dependent, but obviously like Rupi Kaur is probably like the only famous poet today is probably Rupi Kaur.
Well, like, unless you want to count rappers, like one of the things that's interesting about poetry, I think, is that you have on one hand, like poetry has this very small group of people reading one another, and they all, you know, the readers all know each other and the writers all know each other. Yeah. Like there's a sort of insularity in a community that's very small and, you know, interdependent, but, you know, insular in some respects, or fragmented into little niches. But at the same time, you know, if you look on the other end of the spectrum, you know, the most largest cultural impact you can see, rap music is effectively built entirely out of, you know, poetry. I always when I teach anaphora, I teach future. Because all future does is anaphora, you know, like it's the exact same technique that a Babylonian poet would use. And yet, you know, it's derided and dismissed as not poetry by even the poets, you know, which you would think might want to valorize the art. Now, there's reasons, of course, you could imagine that, you know, music and poetry, even with Leonard Cohen, you bring up Leonard Cohen, as you say, you know, there's even a divide in Leonard Cohen's audience between like people who read his poetry and people who listen to his music often, like, you know, some people who do both, but that's sort of a weird niche. Mostly people are doing one or the other, which is curious, you know? And so it's a very strange form in terms of its diversity, but also it's kind of the lack of a public perception of its diversity. In a strange sort of way.
Sure. I mean, poetry on that level, like, you know, poetry is all over the place, right? And especially in music. I mean, I should say, I was talking about my like early influences. I mean, it's just really my own, me having the same kind of conceptual limitations you're talking about, John, that like I didn't talk about rap music, which like hip hop was absolutely my favorite. I loved Leonard Cohen, but I loved hip hop probably more. And certainly through my teens, honestly, through my teens, my mid 30s, I only listened to hip hop. Like I listened, it's like the only thing on my iPod, and every situation I thought it was good. It was, you could drive to it. You could work out to it. It was just good for a party. I really like annoyed a lot of my friends because I didn't like indie rock, and the reason I liked hip hop was obviously that like the verbal energy is like such a huge part of that. So I absolutely agree with that.
And but, now it's consumed everything, including independent music. You know, rap music is such a cultural phenomenon, or hip hop is such a cultural phenomenon, that it's just started consuming all things. Which
Has a trap beat. Everything has a trap beat now.
Yeah, right? And it's good and it's bad. But there's a level at which, it may seem kind of ridiculous to say it, but I can see that influence in a way in your work. Although you're very you're doing very different things. There is that thing that rappers will do where they just keep switching the direction of where they're going. So like they'll often do just formally, like just keep switching the flow. Whereas you tend to do it a bit more on the content level. Like you'll just kind of start the image in one direction and then turn it into another direction. The poem I was talking about most recently in class is the one about, the prime minister giving speech.
I just read that one yesterday again
myself. But so like the first three lines of that, you know, just established the difference between like now and then. Like it seemed like there'd never be a time Obama wasn't president. Now look. And then, you know, you move right away from that, you know, then it like turns right away from that. It seems like it's going to maybe be about Trump or about American politics or something, but it doesn't go in that direction at all. You know, it starts moving into like talking about Canadian prime minister, you know, and then delivering an address at a soldier's funeral, choking up when he says the phrase "the children," you know, and then it kind of so it like establishes the second stanza of that other place that is going to go. So it goes up from then to now to, you know, here's the now to like here's, you know, the media, you know. But, you know, I recognize the media thing. But even so, what I think is so interesting about the poem, that poem, and where I think it captures something that's at the heart of the book in some ways is there's inherently in the idea that even though you know the trick, it still works.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, and everybody knows the trick. Everybody knows it's an insincere expression, but of emotion, but they think of their own. It nevertheless, the trick works, and there's a level at which there's something glorious about that, and so it becomes this interesting metaphor for how poetry operates. Even though you're talking about, you know, this kind of politician making a speech, like it's that technique of like the objective correlative, right? You know, on a certain level, is kind of being explored here, this you know, way in which we're going to reproduce the emotion in the reader by putting things together in a particular fashion, and it is just a trick on a certain level, but it has, you know, this sort of weird beauty and power to it. At the same time, you know, it's dangerous, and there's this interesting like double-sidedness to the trick of it all, and I feel like playing with those tensions is something the book is very interested in, and you seem very interested in.
Yeah, well, that poem, I just to speak a little bit more to that poem, it was, the Canadian Prime Minister I was thinking of, like, I mean, it was watching it on TV, it was Stephen Harper, and he was he's delivering an address at a soldier's funeral, a soldier who had died in Afghanistan. And I describe exactly what happened is that he talked about the soldier, like very sadly having children that he was leaving behind. And, you know, Stephen Harper, famously cold demeanor, he choked up in that moment. And, you know, I don't want to sound too cynical about this stuff, but yeah, if you're trying to give a speech and you want to seem emotive in that moment, like what the actor does is think about something. I mean, it's acting 101. You think about something from your own life. You have an objective correlative in your own memory that will trigger you. And if you can control that, then that comes across in your performance. And so anyway, I don't want to get too political or anything, but that's what I saw happening there. And it was all the more obvious because unlike Obama, who was a great speechifier, Harper was not. And it was a moment that really stuck out to me of him, his performance somehow breaking out of its routine. It made me think about what I was doing, also what I was doing on the page as well.
I think the other thing it gets into thematically is the poem as a media form. and how it relates to or compares to other media forms, like, you know, a televised address and so on. I remember just thinking, you mentioned Harper. So I always think of Trudeau when I read that poem these days, but because you don't name the politician, which is one a great little tech trick. But Harper, I remember, because I was in Calgary at the time that Harper was primarily prime minister. For the most part, that's where I was at the time. And I remember distinctly the one time he was running for his majority. Before he got elected to the majority, I remember there was a debate, a famous debate at the CBC had done this like weird round table where they had like people sitting around at the actual table and they had put the camera like in the middle or something. And they were like jumping from one person to the other. And I remember that when that debate, when I was watching that debate, at one point I just turned the volume down all the way to zero and I just kept watching it. And later on and I just kind of watched like that for like 20 minutes. And later on, people criticized Harper, claiming that he had lost that debate because he refused to actually engage with the other participants. What had happened is every time, you know, somebody was asked a question, they would look at the person who had asked the question and respond to them. But Harper didn't. Harper would look into the camera and respond to the question. So, you know, you had a person sitting beside him. And he's literally not looking at him and instead talking to the camera. And I started noticing this because I noticed it and I turned the volume down just to watch it more. And at the time, people criticized Harper for doing it. And I thought to myself, this man is going to win the majority on that trick alone.
It was a better television performance. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is strange because Harper, I remember famously at the time, was the person who seemed the most ill-suited to television and the most poorly presented, but he was also the first prime minister who had a personal stylist, you know, on staff. It was, you know,
interesting.
It was really a weird, weird moment in Canadian history. And he was a strange politician in strange, interesting ways.
Well, he, but, had, yeah, an without... he had an effective image, you know, I mean, it makes sense to me. It's like, he wanted to be like a normal dad, like a suburban dad. And that part of that is like not being too flashy. Right. So,
It was very strange the way that they would talk about him. I mean, this is a very normal now, but it was at the time an interesting disconnect between like how people would just talk about him in the media and how people would respond to him in the voting booth. And I remember like just kind of, you know, finding it now it's become less strange that there's these weird disconnects and that you have this media. This media in the way all the time. And the role of the media has become, and social media has become so prominent and clear in certain ways. In other ways, it's obfuscated, but it's, we're all more aware of the fact that there is a role that that social media and media plays. And what I think is interesting about a lot of the stuff you're doing in the Anonymous is it seems to me like you're very much getting into on some degree, like what constitutes the poem as a media. And again, that in what ways is it, does it have power as a media or cultural capital as a media? Or in what ways does it lack it? You know, in what ways is it a corrective perhaps, or a way to kind of use something you can use to reassess, you know, other media, or like do that classical defamiliarization project of, you know, freezing. I think McLuhan once talked about the arts as, what their value was they would freeze other media and sort of, you know, start invest. You could kind of investigate it on a weird sort of level. But I always think of like McLuhan-esque sort of ideas in when I'm looking at the Anonymous, though I'm not sure if that's something you would necessarily be kind of doing on, you wouldn't necessarily be throwing to McLuhan, I don't believe on purpose, but I feel like there's a lot of that idea in there of poetry as sort of a media form on a level. And, you know, trying not to forget that and trying to foreground its media, its formal media aspects on a certain level.
Yeah, I mean, that comes from, I've read McLuhan and found him very interesting. I don't know if I was reading him. I don't think I was reading him around the time I was writing this. I think a lot of that, those McLuhan-esque ideas about just thinking about the media with which you're communicating was coming out of this anxiety about, whether what I was doing was going to reach anybody, if it would be worth anything socially, like, was this going to circulate would people respond to it? And there was a lot of, yeah, I mean, there's an anxiety about that, which is one of the reasons I'm kind of trying to reach out kind of beyond the classic poetry on the page, maybe with thinking about the performative elements, you know, what this sounds like if you read it aloud. And also, you know, I have to say at the time I was reading this, like some of probably the media I was consuming the most was like podcasts. And I was like really into at this time, I still listen to them, not as much, like comedy podcasts. So improvised comedy shows, things like Comedy Bang Bang. This was one was like really, it's a kind of an old school comedy podcast now, but it was one I'd listened to for definitely 10 years. And definitely while I was reading this and so just thinking about what could be funny and what could be entertaining in a way that was not typical of poetry on the page, where, you know, you're essentially undermining your traditional authority as a serious writer and serious thinker if you are making jokes. And that's something I definitely know, that's a thing. Like that's a kind of a prejudice towards writing that has a sense of humor, especially in elite circles, academic circles. And so I just didn't care. I was just, you know, when I was writing this, I had actually just finished my PhD. I was like out on the market, out on the job market. And I was teaching and I was moving for work and realizing that some of the values and concerns of the more cloistered academic life were not really relevant out here. And one of them was like, oh yeah, I can be fun. I'm just going to be ghost 100%. Just try to make jokes wherever I can, try to be funny. So yeah, poetry as a medium, very self-aware of it and worried about its limitations and trying to extend beyond them where I could, in ways I think sometimes are more fruitful than others, but it was fun at the time.
Well, this has been really great talking to you about this book, and I really appreciate it. Again, thanks so much for talking to me, Aaron, and I hope you keep writing the wrong way.